Hello and welcome to Mega City Book Club, the podcast about the galaxy's greatest comics, mostly the British ones. I'm Eamon Clark, and my guest is another newcomer to the book club, somebody who emailed me on mcbcpodcast@gmail.com, or from all the way down under. It's a warm welcome to Ant Celestino. Good morning, Ant, or good evening to you, I should say.
Good morning to you, and thanks for having me on.
No problem at all. Thank you for getting in touch. Now, we're going to be talking about an interesting 2000 AD story in a moment. But before we do that, it's your first appearance. So we do 2000 AD origin stories. What were your first experiences with comics and in particular the prog?
First experiences would be, well, basically having piles of comics left around by older siblings, really. And even though I'm kind of like in the age group for to be average 2000 AD reader, luckily I had an older brother that sort of was collecting a few progs, and his first kind of the issues that he had were between 1981 and 1984. I actually have like very clear like memories of it, really, because the first one that I picked up was issue 357, which is like Slain on the cover, and it's incredible Mike McMahon work. You know, he's got like incredible splash page. It's full, you know, interesting stuff. DR and Quinch, Ron Smith's drawing Dread, all those sort of things are right there to hook you in. And also had issues which were, you know, the first issue of like Blockmania, you know, and another one which just happened to be the first issue of Rogue Trooper. And he loved Rogue Trooper. And so, you know, that kind of had him in. So the first ones I were picking up were those, probably from, you know, when I was a bit of a wee lad. But the first issue I kind of bought myself was issue 555, which was like the new logo and the whole kind of like reboot in a way that they had done. And I think I was at that age as a sort of young teenager to pick that up in newsagents and go, oh, I know this, but it looks a bit different to what I remember of it. The paper was a bit better. And flicking through it, you know, taking it home, it's like, I mean, it was all there, you know, Bad Company, John Hinkleton's drawing Torquemada killing Toph, like just mind-blowing stuff. ABC Warriors was like the first time anyone had seen Bisley. Like, I didn't know that that was a new thing, but I was like, this is mind-blowing, you know. And Chopper in Oz is drawn by Will Simpson. So in a roundabout way, kind of leads us to where we are. And, you know, at the same time, first issue of the monthly at the time was Rogue, and it was the Dixie saga. So, I mean, I was just hooked, you know, on the whole thing. So going back and finding a lot of the old back issues in the couple of comic stores that were around. And, you know, comics back then were really interesting because they were just sort of, you didn't feel like they were kids' comics at all. You know, like I think at the same time as like, you know, going out to buy that, you know, getting saving up enough money to go to the actual comic store. And there's only like one or two where I was in Canberra, where I grew up. Well, there's really one. And same from Melbourne when I moved here. But going and then getting the collections and actually finding, you know, the occasional pile in a comic store and just kind of filling in the blanks backwards from there. But from there on, I was just buying 2000 ADs. Until, you know, definitely until the rough years in the 90s.
Right.
Yeah. But there was enough in reprints and whatever to kind of keep you going and always something new to kind of dig into. Yeah.
Okay. So you were reading the period, obviously, that we're going to be talking about in a moment. Well, let's do it. Let's get straight to today's book. What have you chosen to come on the book club with?
I have chosen The War Machine by Dave Gibbons and Will Simpson. And I'm actually looking, I got your note. I know there's the reprinted one. I'm looking at the Heavy Metal and Tundra hardcover.
Oh, yeah, which has got a Will Simpson cover.
Yeah, it has. And it's actually got like a bunch of pages that aren't in the reprinted one, the latest one, I should say.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but look, I probably wouldn't recommend this one because it's great, but but it actually stinks. Like, there's something about, and I found out that other books that they had done in this Tundra series, I don't know what it is about the print process that they use, but they absolutely reek. So I will go back to this every now and then as a reader, but it's a tough read to get through purely for, I don't know, the message that they're trying to send. I mean, it doesn't help the myth, but it's really smelly.
So, as you say, The War Machine by Dave Gibbons and Will Simpson, cover to the Rebellion edition, which I have in digital, is by Henry Flint.
Yeah.
In my collection, I've got extra stories by Michael Fleischer with art by Steve Dillon and Kev Walker, letters by Bambos Giorgio, Tom Frame, and Annie Parkhouse, original commission editor Richard Burton. Stories from 650 to 687 in 1989, 1990, although it's not a continuous run, there's gaps, or there were progs that didn't appear in, which we'll mention in a moment. And then the two extra stories I have, the famous Rogue Trooper annual of 1991 and the 2000 AD yearbook 1992. Right, so that's the facts and figures. Now, you contacted me and we discussed a couple of titles, one of which is coming up with another newcomer shortly. So tell me about this one, why you chose The War Machine for the book club.
Look, I thought it'd be fun to delve into something kind of controversial, kind of derided. There's this love-hate thing that people have with Rogue, and I definitely love and hate, Rogue. But, so many of those kind of garbage storylines after the Traitor General's killed in the original run. But this one actually is like stands out as a real gem, like amongst all of that stuff. And it's very self-contained, which is like completely different to so many other strips. And, and then on top of all of that, like there's a lot to talk about there, but just the other side of it is just Will Simpson just doesn't get his chocolates enough, in my opinion, in the pantheon of 2000 AD artists. Any way to kind of just, for me personally, to go back and just always be looking at his artwork and delving into those stories that I kind of love along the way as being really fun. But also the thing is, it's a graphic novel ready story, which I think at the time, obviously there's a Horned God, and this one just fell in the shadows a bit because of obviously the production stuff that we can go into. But yeah, it just feels like a fun self-contained read. And for me to kind of delve in on this side of things, it's been really fun to just have something to focus on. But I feel it's something that should be addressed at some point. So here we are.
Here we are. Okay. Well, we're certainly going to have some excitement talking about the artwork in a moment. But before we do that, let's just go back to the sort of brief synopsis of this story. I mean, I'm going to guess that pretty much all my listeners are familiar with Rogue Trooper. This self-contained story from the late 80s, maybe not. So what are the basic setup of this one, and in particular some of the differences from Rogue Trooper?
So the basic synopsis setup is this is, Rogue, well, Friday is a genetically engineered clone soldier who's part of a battalion that's bred and programmed for war and dropped into a battle zone where they're all inexplicably killed, except for a lone infantryman who, confused by the circumstances of the betrayal of his platoon and motivated by maybe PTSD and existential pondering, takes a bit of a road trip across a war-torn hellscape. And then he flies to the moon and discovers the real enemy is capitalism. So it's Hamburger Hill meets Paris, Texas, Into the Wild, AI, the motion picture, and then ends in, has the corporations playing God theme a bit from, it's a bit Blade Runner, it's a bit RoboCop, it's a bit Gattaca. And it's Technicolor this time. That's the difference.
Certainly is, yes.
It's one of the key differences, yeah.
And were you, a big fan of the original Rogue Trooper? You mentioned it appeared on the first collection of the monthly.
Yeah, Look, I was, and this one's radically different, you know, like at its core, like Rogue is a revenge story. You know, he doesn't want to bring anyone to justice. He just wants to avenge his buddies. But he's also this like mystery, like when we start with Rogue originally, he's this urban myth, you know, mystery urban myth. Both sides kind of fear him. Nobody is like, great, let me help you. You know, like he's a bit of a Sasquatch really. And, but he knows who he is and he's a single-minded mission that he's on. Whereas I think Friday, from a practical storytelling difference, that's, you know, it's kind of like the big difference is the original Rogue has these biochips. His buddies are still there. It's still actually kind of like an active one-man platoon. Whereas, you know, doing a bit of the kung fu, a bit of the, what was it? Richard Kimball, what was it?
The Fugitive.
The Fugitive, yeah, that's it. This is kind of like a bit of the Fugitive, a bit of Kane from Kung Fu. And it's like, it's, you know, and the original just really is kind of like, has a very much, if you grew up in the 70s, if you grew up in the early 80s, or definitely the 70s, war comics were lying around everywhere, you know? So you're very familiar with the kind of war comic trope. And this was just a futuristic thing, you know, but like thematically, there's pretty big differences, I think, between the first storyline, you know, like, which like could do a bit of a deep dive into that further along. But yeah, like the first one definitely, it just has such a soft spot for so many people, even though there's a lot of kind of like issues, I think, that even the first kind of run has overall. But yeah, this one's just is a completely different thing. As you know, as you said, it's like a hard reboot. You know, maybe too hard a reboot in some ways. But it's also kind of like Dave Gibbons kind of wanting to do his thing. You know, obviously this maybe was on his mind for some time.
Well, let's talk about that. Because, I mean, obviously the creation of the original Rogue Trooper, Jerry Finley Day, yeah. Dave Gibbons, we all know about the Reader's Poll saying they wanted a future war story. There's this weird original idea that he's some sort of Eurofighter mix of parts. And then Jerry Finley Day comes up instead with the biochips idea, which I gather Dave Gibbons never really liked. So 1989.
You reckon?
Richard Burton offers Dave Gibbons a chance to reboot the character. What do you know about Gibbons' sort of intentions and his ideas for the reboot, or the stuff he didn't like about the original?
Yeah. Well, yeah, originally Jerry Finley Day, you know, has this idea for the, you know, the Tube Trooper, he calls him. And yeah, he definitely wanted to do, you know, Dave has mentioned several times, you know, this idea of like the Euro soldier with legs from Italy so he could run away. Which is not the most racist idea floated in 2000 AD, I can say. So yeah, as a Italian, I'm fine with that. But but you know, the idea is that he's kind of like this cursed guy, and he can't die, and he just regenerate all the time, and basically he's walking around in hell. And they didn't go that way. They kind of went with the biochips eventually after Steve McManus pulled them in and sort of made them hash it out. To do that, which is actually kind of like the biochips is a lot more interesting, because like from today's perspective, you know, you download your whole personality onto a chip and then it goes into a new body. So it's kind of a bit of a workaround on that Eternal Soldier idea. But yeah, I mean, like the two of them did like work. Dave's contribution to it is incredible. You know, he based the Nort outfits on American gas suits that were used in Vietnam when they were kind of like the Agent Orange stuff. And I think when it came around again, you know, they're having a bit of a rough run there with Rogue for like the hit series, and they just absolutely killed him off with it and buried him in, I think it was like a sci-fi special or something like that, that Chris Weston illustrated, which was actually quite nice. But then Richard Burton taps John Smith, you know, to give it a crack, and then they do Cinnabar, and it's actually a success. And they say, okay, so Rogue actually has some legs given the right story. So they get on to Dave, and he kind of looks at it like it's his chance to put everything into Rogue that he thought was missing, you know, and his chance to get rid of the biochips.
I've got the quote. It was my chance to put everything into Rogue Trooper I wanted and take out all the crap like the biochips.
Yeah.
Not a fan.
It's ironically, he has a chip on his shoulder, you know, but don't. But yeah, it's an interesting one, you know. Like Dave definitely has a different approach to the character, you know. Like I think I really like what he's doing as a writer, and yeah, you know, he had all that original input on the original run, and he has sort of said that he would get sort of scripts from Jerry and then kind of adapt them himself, and where it ended up was where it ended up. And on this one, he goes for the whole Jesus myth. Which I'm not sure if he succeeds on, but, you know, he does try to keep a couple of the cooler ideas, like the trope of Rogue digging in, which after a while in the original run, it became like a complete kind of joke, you know, oh, he's popping up out of the ground again. And, you know, like how did he get in the ground in the last 2 seconds, you know, two panels previously. But in this one, he kind of like, he does it. It was kind of comical, but in this sort of more serious version, it's actually kind of cool. So he handles it like with a lot more class. And I think like he's just generally coming up with something a bit more relatable about the late 80s. You know, with the original comic strip was kind of conceived, it was more like, you know, we're at battle with these commie Nazis, you know, space Nazis. And they're these definitive bad guys with, you know, outrageous tech, you know, Dreamweavers, BioWire, etc. Whereas this one focuses a bit more on soldiers of both sides just being cogs in the machine of war. So, you know, he's hanging out with these heavyweight guys like Alan Moore and Frank Miller, which I think maybe Frank Miller might have come after this actually, but he clearly wants to write, you know, and I think yeah. Like this is definitely his chance to kind of like, you know, look at this and give it that, yeah, like you said, you know, his chance to put everything right. And return to the, he says, you know, returns to the idea of him being haunted in an emotional way by the dead platoon mates, you know, rather than having kind of like a silly bit of silicon in his equipment. And he says in, I think, Conflabulation, his book, he says, the problem I always had with Rogue was his rucksack had more personality than he did. So it's kind of like, it's a weird one because then he kind of doesn't give the new Rogue more personality. It just makes him more of a kind of like robotic, you know, programmed thing, like literal, you know, war machine. Yeah.
It's interesting you say about him having PTSD because he does seem, after the sort of conflict of Hill 392, that he's just wandering around. Sort of being rather miserable for a long period of time.
Yeah. No, completely, you know, like, and I think that that's kind of like, I get what he's going for sure. Like, you know, he's kind of like this very blank slate, almost, you know, program. I like to think of him almost like as a chess computer, you know, and he's just like, he's just got this very simple programming, and then eventually, you know, the whole thing is overcoming that, or finding, you know, the flaw in his genetic makeup is that he actually is like a little bit human. And obviously that's the thing that I think Jerry kind of got right from the start, is like the original strip is all about humanity, right? And this one should be as well. Like, he's striving to find some humanity, but it's a little bit, I don't know, like, I think it's just like, because he goes overboard on the robotic war machine programming and, you know, the constant sort of narration boxes and everything, that he struggles in kind of like finding that humanity. And it's the other thing is, it's because it's so self-contained, you don't have that serialized, you know, the journey is very serialized in the first strip. So, you know, he goes from one place to the next and he's encountering all these things, and there's ways that he's sort of seen all these soldiers that have lost their own humanity through the war, and he becomes this kind of counterpoint because he's the most inhuman thing there is on the planet. Whereas I think with Friday and in the War Machine, he doesn't have that, you know, that opportunity to explore that, because, you know, it's 14 issues. It's kind of like, we got to get through this. There's a lot of ground to cover, and, you know, we've got, you know, half of it is, you know, or maybe a quarter of it, yeah, a third of it, I'd say, is this battle action sequence, which is fantastic. A third of it is this kind of like road trip part where he's like, oh, this is what other people was happening to other people. And he's, and then the last part is this kind of like reckoning, you know, breaking free of his programming. So yeah, I don't know if Dave gets there entirely, but he has a good crack at it. And it's actually a pretty good read itself when collected in these editions. Yeah.
Do you find that instead of the biochips, as you say, he's haunted by the memories of his dead teammates, and they appear in sort of flashback memory sequences. Is that enough of a difference from the original? I mean, I suppose they're not popping up and offering him equipment and advice in dangerous situations. They're just popping up as memories, I suppose.
Yeah, yeah. Like, to biochip or not biochip is always like the question, yes. Right? So, but, you know, again, going back to that statement, you know, about the problem is, you know, the backpack has more personality. It's like, what are the mental gymnastics involved in giving, you know, Friday the personality of a blank slate, you know, toddler, you know? And his mates don't haunt him enough. Like, they have a couple of lines of dialogue that aren't very motivational at all. You know, it's kind of like, oh, hey, man, like, here's my gun. You know, like,
it's the best gun.
It's the best gun. Or, hey, you would not like the rest of us like this. And then they kind of like pop up. So they didn't really flesh out his buddies enough to haunt him in a really motivational way. But with the biochips, there's this like genuine complicated relationship and motivations. Like, Bagman has like got his protein breakdown. He goes kooky. You know, Helm has a hero complex, and Rogue steals his girl. You know, Gunner is basically kill crazed psycho that prefers, you know, the sniper. Like when they go to that, the Morgan, the sniper, you know, like Rogue is actually kind of like, oh, I'm preferred by being handled by this guy. Like they don't even like Rogue most of the time. He's just this mule, right? And once they're regened, they don't even really want to hang out with him. Like, it's kind of like Rogue's the loser out of the gang, like, which is crazy. But, you know, and then there's also the race to get the traitor. Like, they have to kind of get him because, you know, at any point he could catch a straight bullet and that's it. And they kind of explore that really well. I think there's a really fun strip that Steve Dillon wrote, which is basically all biochips, just, you know, chatting and kind of like live, you know, it's a dream from, you know, one of them. But, you know, I think like Dave Gibbons, you know, touches on it during the road trip phase of it, but it doesn't really feel immediate, you know, like there's no stakes in the way that there were stakes with the biochips around, for sure.
And once they've wiped out most of the genetic troopers and he's just wandering this war zone, it does have the problem, I suppose, that there aren't an awful lot of characters for him to talk to. So then we get a lot, as you say, of narration boxes. Now, it's 1989. Dave Gibbons obviously has done Watchmen. He's world famous at this point as an artist. Yeah. He's worked with probably the person who does narrative text box as a writer, mm-hmm. probably better than anyone else.
Yeah.
I must confess, Ant, I did struggle slightly with some of the narrative bits in this.
Oh, man. Yeah, it's... no, I'm just actually looking for the issue here. I've got it lying around. But, you know, I'm surrounded by progs, hardcovers. There's so many different reprints of this. There was a heavy metal reprint. There was the magazine reprint. Like, they're all kind of... But, like, there is... Like, this story is plagued by narration. And it detracts so much from the story. But in a weird flip, it does add to the story as well. Like, look, in Prog 668, he says, I'm coming in high side 6 times, right? And it's in the same place on each page. And it's kind of like, come on, man. Like, okay, cool. We get it. Like, Alan Moore might get away with it. Yeah, because he would do it. But, you know, one funny thing is, like, just as a sidebar, in Prog 667, there's 2 pages with text boxes completely out of order, and there's no way to logically read them without a reprint in front of you to make it line up. Like, I cannot make, to this day, it's like a magic eye. I can't make the text boxes line up, and it's just complete chaos. And then, you know, actually, the Tundra copy adds a few pages, which is a bit of a direct, like, it takes some of those text boxes and puts them on their own page.
Okay.
I'll send you some screen grabs. Like it's actually, I'll take some photos and send it. It works a lot better in some ways, but it's kind of like, it's so much. It doesn't help the story. And I think he's trying to start with it being minimal and then building more like humanistic sort of talk as it goes. It does get there. He could have done the same thing with the text box and actually had a lot less narration as it goes. And then, you know, add it kind of back in towards the end. I mean, the funny thing is, and we can kind of go into it afterwards, but like after this, you know, the Fleischer period is I find narration to be a very American thing. And, you know, like to that level, like after this, like the Fleischer feels a bit like Punisher War Journal territory. Like it's just, oh, that's a cup of coffee that I'm looking at. Like, and you know, like I'm in a fight and I'm thinking about the whole fight through the fight. It's like, come on. So I see what he's doing with it to kind of get this like internal monologue to get the drift between the programmed guy and sort of like break into the humanity, but it's just a bit overboard, isn't it? Maybe a director's cut would be good, you know. But overall, I think Dave understands the scale of things. Like he's one of those few artists actually that can do scale. Like, you know, if we look at guys like Ron Smith or Mick McMahon, you know, but they're so good at like getting the visual storytelling across. And Dave is incredible at his visual storytelling. But for some reason, the way he's written this sort of doesn't give the world, you know, a chance to kind of like expand and breathe as much as Will does a great job of it. Now, that could also have to do with like the episodic nature of the original, which did a lot better job of the world building because every other week he's some different zone, you know, and whereas this one's kind of launching into this single epic off the bat doesn't help. And then the other thing is, because of the relentless narration, there's no fun in the War Machine. Like, I'm not saying you have to go full disco rogue, you know, disco dancing rogue, which in itself is insane. But you've got to remember, in the same scene of disco dancing rogue, Bagman blows up the girls on the dance floor, right? Like, whereas Friday is just grim. And if you're kind of like walking around, like you were saying, in this, you know, depressing world with kind of like he's moping, it's just the narration's not the last thing you want to hear. Especially, and to be honest, as a teenager, I kind of might have liked it a bit, being kind of like that age. But as you get older, it's kind of like, oh, geez, what was he thinking? You know, like like Friday comes across a bit kind of like he goes from being a toddler to this like mopey teenager to, you know, takes control of his own destiny towards the end, which is kind of nice, but it's very literal, you know.
Yeah. It does have a beginning, a middle, and an end. And as you say, it makes a nice concise reprint, a graphic novel size, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It works well for that. This is a story with an ending, as it were.
Yeah.
Although he sort of, I guess, you know, without too many spoilers, he sort of, by the end of the book, he has become the rogue trooper in a way. But yeah, okay. Yeah. So it works well there.
Hmm.
Let's turn away from Dave's writing. We'll mention Dave's art for a moment because obviously it was originally intended he would draw this himself. But as we've said, 1989, 90, he is incredibly busy and famous. Martha Washington with Frank Miller is probably, I can't remember when that was, but that's probably coming along.
Yeah, I think he's working on that at the same time, to be honest.
Right.
I think that's the drawing job that's got him busy. Yeah. But I think from the dates, because I think Martha Washington is maybe 91 or 90. I have to go and check on that. Like, I'm sure someone will correct me on that. But yeah, I think that's on the horizon. So when he says he's busy, you better believe it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's Dave Gibbons. He's always in demand. Yeah. So yeah. All right. Well, let's turn to the artwork.
Mm.
Will Simpson.
Yeah.
Had previously worked on, before 2000 AD, Big Ben and Transformers, Judge Dredd, then he goes on to Hellblazer and Batman. Game of Thrones is probably his biggest gig, the storyboards for that. Now, this is painted artwork. Is it watercolor painting, you think, that he's doing?
I believe it's gouache, maybe some watercolors in there. I mean, you know, it's Will Simpson, you know, and like, I mean, he's definitely in my top 10 2080 artists. You know, he's got this kind of Michelangelo, Da Vinci, if they were interested in sci-fi. You know, he came up with Don Lawrence, like, was an inspiration. War Picture Library was inspiration. It was one of his influences. And he's, you know, I think his earlier color stuff in Dread is much better than this, but like, this is pretty great. And to be honest, I actually really love his black and white work the most. Kind of has a bit of a Kim Raymond vibe, if you kind of go back and, you know, is in there. And actually, he did, I don't know if it's before or after, but he did I think it might have been for Image, he did a Alien comic, which was called Alien Rogue. And that is sublime stuff. Like, he could draw Space Marines all day. Like, he's the perfect artist to do Rogue Trooper, actually, if you right. think about it. You know, but the thing is, I think I'd much rather see him do Rogue in black and white, you know, because like,
right.
we'd seen his like Tyranny Rex stuff, the Universal Soldier thing that he'd done. He's like so good at doing these kind of like high techs, you know, like future stuff. And he's great with doing the war things and just the gritty as well. Like, no one can do action in the rain like Will Simpson, you know, like, really. His Dread is in my top 10 other artists. Mm. Like, if I had to say, you know, Carlos, Mike McMahon, Boland, Ron Smith, Brendan McCarthy, Henry Flint, Steve Dillon, he's like in that same list for me, you know, Cam Kennedy, like, he's, you know, right there. And the same thing with, you know, Colin Wilson, the same thing with the Rogue artists. And Dread artists, he's right there as well for me with his work. You know, I've never actually watched Game of Thrones.
Oh, right, okay.
But I'm super familiar with his artwork for it. Yeah,
right.
And a lot of his other strips. Yeah, he has such a unique style. I think it's really fascinating, and the color stuff is definitely incredible. Definitely doesn't get a shout out enough, I think. In my opinion.
Well, that's interesting because it's 1989-1990, which, of course, is Horned God time period. And Simon Bisley's artwork for the Horned God gets all the attention.
Yeah.
And for a certain period of time thereafter, everybody seems to be trying to either be the next Simon Bisley or to do their version of it. But here's Will Simpson's fully painted artwork. Doesn't, as you say, necessarily get all the plaudits that it should do. It seems like, personally, I think I would make more fuss about this myself.
I'm with you, man. Like, it's so funny, isn't it? Because, like, no one's... I mean, the Horn God is undeniable, right? But also, Bisley's style is changing book to book in that as well, you know? I'm one of those guys that love Bisley's, you know, the ABC Warriors stuff, that highly detailed thing stuff. And I think it's the same thing here with Will. He's trying some really interesting stuff. I mean, this is like looking at, you know, William Turner in the pages of 2000 AD. Like, it's crazy stuff. I think the breakdowns in the episodic nature of it, like, you know, the delays probably, like, but also having a look at it, there is a lot of strong competition. I was just like, we got some progs here. And it's like, look at that. It's like the cover of this one's Dread, I Quit. You know, like, you know, like Carlos, you know, it's like he's competing for the attention of some absolute, you know, guys at the storylines that are at the peak. Yeah, for sure. That's an interesting...
Yeah, I mean, we've just had the Dead Man. It's the build-up to Necropolis. The Horned God is happening. Yeah, there is an awful lot of competition, but we do have Will Simpson's beautifully painted artwork to look at. We mentioned the story has a beginning, a middle, and end. The beginning, of course, is the war scenes in particular. And obviously, the thing we learn from comic books is war is hell. This is the first time where it appears to be literal hell. It's, you know, I've never seen the chaos, the confusion, the sort of the horror, the panicky horror of being in a war zone as, you know, when it's depicted by Will Simpson in these pages. Tell us something about the artwork and what you make of it, and particularly in these opening chapters.
Yeah, that's actually so well put. You know, they're almost like a Hieronymus Bosch style level of just like you can just dig into each panel and they're just like the scale in them is incredible. You know, I think like the thing about it is it's kind of the wrong medium for this because, you know, like the artwork is sublime. And actually, like in this heavy metal Tundra version, the artwork comparing it page by page with the progs and some of the other prints, they've fixed a lot of it. Like the blues are like suddenly better. It's sharper. The scans might have let them down with some of these reprints as well. And even I think in the original. But the thing is, you know, these guys are using colors like that CMYK just can't reproduce. You know, like CMYK has a really, I used to be a graphic designer, so I'm kind of very deep in this stuff. CMYK has a very narrow gamut, especially the deep blues, the greens, the purples. So they get compressed in conversion. And it's also like the paint that he would have been using is very reflective, like light bounces off it, so it has depth. But when you actually print anything in ink, especially on uncoated paper, let alone the sort of like toilet paper 2080s use, it just absorbs the light. So dark tones get heavier, contrast is lower, the mid-tones and shadows get crushed and very muddy in print. But there's things you can do, and I think Will is doing a few of those things. And I know I've read Bill, I can never say, Bill Sienkiewicz? Bill
Sienkiewicz?
Sienkiewicz, yeah. Bill Sienkiewicz adapts his workflow because of the reproduction process. And I think Will's doing some of that stuff, but not like, I think he's experimenting in, he's kind of going full Will Simpson on this from what we'd seen previously. So in the same way, I think like Bisley's going full Bisley, these guys are just experimenting out of their effing minds and going as peak as they can. So like for Will to do the war scene, you're right. He is like being briefed, war is hell. He's taken this to the absolute nth degree. And sometimes that comes out completely muddy and maybe that's good for the story, you know, and sometimes it can take you out of it a little bit as a reader when it's only a few pages that are kind of like being printed here and there. But I mean, it definitely had competition across the board when this came out, because I think like that Prog 650 or whatever it was when it came out, that was like a massive, you know, reboot storyline wise. So yeah, it's the artwork is doing its best to compete with, you know, you've got Steve Yowell doing ridiculous, you know, black and white in Zenith 3. And yeah, there's other stuff happening. It was just like, I think it was just didn't capture people's attention. I think it captured my attention and the reprint works so well, but I don't know, just like in the, you know, the wider library of stories maybe might be a bit overlooked. And I think it's probably why it's super exciting to talk about it now and, you know, come back to it.
Now, I've got the Rebellion collection in digital, and I said to you in my notes that, you know, I think I needed a bigger page size, and of course digital can make things look a bit dark and muddy.
Yeah,
I'm interested in the sort of heavy metal reprint, although, as you say, it smells terribly. It's the paper the binding. Yeah,
it does.
It's weird when you buy these trades and they do smell, but it doesn't wear off on that one, apparently.
Yeah, it's not worn off at all. Yeah, and I've seen another, I can't remember which one was, that stinks as well. But yeah, it's the reproductions is a funny one, isn't it? I think sometimes I get the reproductions right and sometimes I get it wrong. And, you know, I'm not too sure about the Rebellion one. I mean, it's not the best, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
It's, yeah, they kind of like, it seems a bit like an afterthought, that one. They really should have gone a bit deeper into working on the reproduction, but it's still, I don't think, still a great way to have it on the shelf, you know, if you can't find the heavy metal one. For sure.
Now, Will Simpson is a Northern Ireland artist, and I met him at the Enniskillen Comic Fest earlier this year, where he was in his own little room with some of his personal collection of his own art on display, including a Friday page. So I did get to see some of his painted work close up. Just stunning. Yeah. Just yeah. Amazing. And what a nice guy as well.
Right.
Know, so... really lovely guy. So glad that he's had a lot of success, and particularly with his film and TV work. But this is astonishing. Of course, one of the problems we know with painted artwork, it can cause delays. And there were gaps in the production, or, you know, it didn't run continuously in the progs, did it?
No. It's like you got four issues followed by... like it's like 14 or 15 prog break. You know, they said it was going to be a 10 prog break. That's what they promised. And it was 10 or 15, 14 or 15. And that's right in the middle of the action on Hill 392. That just breaks the flow. You know, they come back, there's text box out of order. You know, I don't know who was in charge. Like on one of the intro pages, it's listed as Hill 390, you know, then it goes missing again. After prog 671 until 683, you know, there's entire runs of strips in the gaps, like Shadows, Kronos Carnival, Simon Colby drawing Universal Soldier. There's like John Smith, Chris Weston, Indigo Prime stuff. It's like, that's not going to help. Yeah, like that's not conducive to like getting people locked on this particular story. The art gaps, the delays really did hurt this in its original run.
Do you think that's partly why it's not, you know, maintained its reputation, or it's got a reputation as being not great?
Yeah, I mean, it's in your notes you're saying, yeah, competing with Dead Man, Necropolis and Horn God, right? It's like, I mean, look, yeah, it's worth noting Horn God and David Roach drawing Anderson there is like very distracting for a teenage boy. You know, there's even like a sex scene in Necropolis, in like Countdown to Necropolis. So it's like as a teenager, you're kind of like being drawn to other stuff. But there's also huge stuff happening in Zenith, you know. You know, the run up to Necropolis was strong with like Young Giant. There was the end of the Strontz, you know, like Stranium Dog, Final Solution is in there. Chopper, Song of the Surfer. You know, like there's so much other stuff happening. There's even Crisis and Deadline at the time that are like there for, you know, other stuff. Then there even like really stuff that's kind of like not the greatest things, which I really love Beyond Zero. Like it's one of my favorite stories, you know, like in there, but like, I even like Bix Barton. So like, even the future shocks in this period were pretty good. So it's kind of like, I think just overall, you wouldn't be blamed for not having it at the top of your, you know, thoughts in some ways this period, unless you're a diehard Rogue fan, I think like myself. Well, up to this point, diehard Rogue fan, you know.
Right.
But there was a cracking run of strips, you know. But, like, the editorial choices as well, you know, they made the great move to put more color in. But the thing is, I think ultimately it just fails because it fails to make a dent because you just don't read a graphic novel over 6 months. Like,
right.
That's the thing, yeah. Yeah, if it was a couple of stories here and there, like, Rogue going from here to there, yeah, the break is fine. But in this particular story, no, it's just too fragmented.
So there are other Friday stories. There's two of them in this book, in my collection anyway. The Biodeath with Steve Dillon artwork, and then Arena of the Long Knives with Kev Walker, both written by Michael Fleischer. Are they in your collection?
No, but I did bring that the Rebellion collection up and have a read of it. Yeah, it's right. They're reprinted from that annual. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Not great.
They're not great, no. That's probably the best thing to say about them.
No, look, I mean, yeah. Do they do anything that couldn't be done? Like with the original Rogue? Like definitely, I think you could do both with the original Rogue. There's nothing there. But like the Kevin Walker Alien Gladiator storyline actually probably would have tarnished the legacy of the original Rogue if they had done that. Like, you know, fans love the original Rogue because of this kind of like kung fu fugitive side quest. Like the side quests resolve themselves in ways that either progress the character or plot, you know, whereas Rogue's missions remain unchanged at the end of his kind of like little side quests, right? But you look at these and it's like, what is the point? And then secondly, like if Friday helps out some grunts who betray him, you can file that under the like war is hell banner, right? But then when he gets zapped to some alien, you know, arena to fight another really tough guy, and then he kind of like walks out of it after reaffirming, you know, he was engineered to fight. Yeah, that's why he's really good at fighting. It's like it's a fart in the wind. Like it's just it's just, you know. Oh, I mean,
Okay, there's also Spaceminute 2000 has recently covered the original Rogue crossover with Friday, which I confess I'd forgotten all about until I heard them talking about it recently. Yeah. Do you have any memories of that one?
Look, I despise what they did with Rogue and Friday after War Machine. Like,
it's there we go, just, right?
Like, I think I basically move it into... I describe it as Fleischer's War on 2000 AD. Right. You know, like I know in Thrill Power Overload, Alan McKenzie says Fleischer was embarrassing. You know, his work was embarrassing and he did his best to save it, but you couldn't polish a turd, right? And I think like Fleischer is so good at being terrible that he even made me like somehow managed to completely erase reading a Ron Smith illustrated strip, right? Which is a massive achievement, right? Like the way what he did pulling in like Ron to work on Rogue was just horrendous, you know? And I did have a browse of the crossover stuff when they covered on Space Spinner, because I've kind of like been reading along with those guys, but it's so dialogue heavy and Henry Flint's comic style like totally ejected me from it, which is crazy because now I love Henry's style. He's one of my favorite artists now, but just like completely went down the wrong direction for it. So yeah, no, you know, like I think Fleischer just didn't get it at all. Like Rogue is all about the humanity, you know, and Friday is just like trying to find his humanity. You know, Rogue is a Ronin samurai. Friday is the confused, you know, PTSD, you know, child. And in the hands of Fleischer, it's something that he understands even less. I like just looking through that story that's reprinted here, there is a section in the fight scene where Friday's narration says, "I was born not to drink the cup of life, but to die thirsting for battle. It is fear of death, however slight, that makes that makes like the other guy vulnerable. In his humanity, however twisted, that handicaps him." It is utter tosh. Like, just, it is just throw it out now, you know? And it's a shame because, you know, who doesn't love Steve Dillon? Who doesn't love Kev Walker? You know, it's just far out, man. What Fleischer does is just nasty, nasty stuff. Ugh. I gotta take a shower after talking about Fleischer. Just flush
it. Okay. So the other Friday stories are not great. Let's say that. Let's turn back to the original and move to safer ground and play Grail Pages. Mm. Let's imagine that we could afford any of Will Simpson's art.
Oh,
or the other art that's, you know, that I've mentioned. But I suspect we're going to be sticking with Will Simpson. What are you going to pick as your pages, Ant?
This is really hard, and I hate to be kind of such a simp about it, but it's got to be 687, the wraparound cover. It just says it all, like, really, at the end. There's so many really good action pages in the fight, in the sort of, like, Hill 392 sequence. There's a few in there where he's got really dynamic boxes, like the illustration boxes, and the flow of them is really amazing. But I think just for pure Rogue solo soldier, I think this cover kind of gets it, and it's a good reflection of, I've got it here. I'm just digging it out. It is this, just before the original Rogue run, you have this, got it here, the Dave Gibbons War, like, splashback cover, you know? So I kind of like it, sort of complements that same sort of vibe. And I could just picture, you know, like a big war behind it. Unfortunately, they've written Battlefield Blues, like they put a pun instead on it. But anyway, the original art, and I've seen the original art on Will's Instagram, and I assume you would have seen that at Inniskillen. But yeah, great stuff. It's incredible. Yeah. That would be
the wraparound. To wrap around cover to Prog 687.
And in the Tundra version, they put that in towards the end. I'm just sort of holding it.
Oh, right. Yeah,
so
there
they
you go.
They actually use that towards the end, and they change the last page instead of him sort of walking away. It's just like a picture of the earth that he's painted, which is kind of nice. But I think that one would be, a grail page for sure. Has to be.
Okay. Any others to mention?
Oof. Yeah, there's a few. Also, the cover for this copy is one of the pages inside of here as well. There's some really good stuff. Yeah, I think it's mostly just in the war section, kind of like, he's kind of like got this big kind of kill thing. And there is actually, it's a bit morbid, but I love the pages where Top dies and he's been blown in half. And it's kind of like, it's just this fiery paint in the background that's incredible. It's like, I love that page as well. I think he's doing some amazing stuff there. Like I said, it stands up next to Bisley's Horn Guard, pound for pound, punch for punch. It's incredible. So I definitely put that down.
Okay, so I'm going to give you those two covers and also the page of Top as well, as grail pages, and I'll post all these on all the socials when this episode comes out.
Yeah.
I'm just going to pick page 38 in the digital, which is a sort of Friday walking away through, or in fact, no, actually, it's probably one of those Dark Knight Returns cover things. He's probably walking towards us through the sort of carcass of some great war machine. The sky is lit with horrors. 150 miles to go south, keep moving, skirt the supply base. I just love the colors and the sort of I love all of Will Simpson's battle sequences and the way he depicts the battlefield. It's just great. But again, I'll post that when this episode comes out.
Yeah, I wish you could see this version, because the colors are so much more vibrant and are popping. Like, it's dark here now, so it's kind of, you won't see it. But I'll try and take some scans and send them to you, because they're actually so much better, like these big pages. But that's an incredible page. I do love the way Will draws soldiers and the sort of futuristic outfits as well. Like, on the very next page, it's a kind of a bit of a grim scene, but like, I do love the way he's done these soldiers as well. And I love that for sure. I could pick so many pages from this. I could pick individual panels from this strip, you know, for grail panels, but
I mean, individual pages, the splash pages, in fact, any of Will Simpson pages we'd be happy with.
I mean, worth mentioning, so I just forgot it earlier, but like, the thing is, in I got it here somewhere in a sci-fi special, here it is, sci-fi special from whatever year it was, 1988, Will's drawing Venus Blue Jeans, and I think they're pulling up. That's a complete like test run for what War Machine could be like, right there. It's incredible. So it was good to see kind of like Will coming back and doing that. And like I said, like, that's actually written by Grant Morrison, that's true, and it's kind of like almost feels a bit zenithy in the black and white, but his black and white stuff would have been so good for this, I think. And you kind of see it a bit on those pages where he's, you know, the the underdrawings come through a little bit more on the painting. I think that that really helps rather than the kind of like super abstracty, full painterly stuff. Yeah.
Well, the War Machine is available in the Rebellion collection from the 2000E store. It's currently only $5.99, although it's on sale at the moment. It's normally $9.99. It's not available in the paperback anymore there, but you can find copies on eBay, and you can find the Heavy Metal Tundra reprint on there as well. But Ant has a note about the pages being smelly.
Yeah.
Anything else you wanted to say about the War Machine, Ant, before we move on?
I mean, look, you can really dig into this so much more. You know, there's, look, it's got its problems, you know, but I think thematically there's some really crazy stuff that's happening there. Like, I think one of the things is kind of like, if you really dive deep into it, you know, the first Rogue is such a, you know, strip of its time, you know, thematically, kind of like, it's the government putting us in this hell, you know, early 80s, you know, Thatcher era kind of vibe. Whereas the War Machine, I think, reflects more, you know, ideas about corporate overreach and capitalism being the source of society's problems. So it's kind of like can be a bit of an interesting, you know, that might be a bit of a reach, but I think it might be a theme Dave Gibbons is feeling in the aftertaste from working with Alan Moore. And I think, you know, seeing them try some of this more serious stuff in the strip is definitely worth visiting. And the fact that it's an actual self-contained graphic novel in itself, it's kind of like, it's not too much to bite off to have a read of, you know. I think it's a good, for anyone who kind of like fancies a serious comic, definitely overlooked in that period, obviously, because of some of the big, you know, American stuff. But I think as far as the Brit comics go, this one should be right up there and should be in anyone's collection, you know. But I can't speak highly enough of it, flawed and all. And I really do actually like what Dave has done here, and obviously love what Will's done, but I really do like what Dave has done here. As much as it has some issues, I love it, you know. Yeah.
Well, some of the flawed ones make for the most interesting discussions, and I think it's well worth a revisit. It is, as you say, it's nice and contained. You can read it pretty much in one sitting.
Yeah.
As opposed to having to wait over 6 months for it to finish in the prog, you know.
Yeah.
I'm glad you picked it. It was great fun. And of course, the art is just stellar. Amazing.
Yeah.
Cool. Thank you so much, Ant. So, guest projects. Tell us, now we were talking before we started recording. Am I right in thinking jingles?
Yeah. So, yeah, I work in the music biz, and I was inspired by Fox on Space Spinner. Every time they do, you know, ABC Warriors, he'd be like, ABC Warriors. He'd have his own little jingle for it. Like,
yeah.
And I thought I'm going to go out and just make that myself. And so I started making these like little theme songs and imaginary theme songs and jingles for strips. And, you know, you can do some of this stuff now. And so, yeah, I'm kind of like, that's my pet project. At the moment, I'm working on creating like maybe a YouTube channel or an Instagram or something, which just has these little songs and pulled together for imaginary TV shows or ads or toys or whatever it is. And so, yeah, I've been toying around with creating this. Like, I really like that idea of like those 80s and 90s TV, Saturday morning TV blocks, you know, like where you just have a bunch of TV shows that, you know, would go to's. And so kind of like coming up with a 2000 AD themed one. And I've got a bunch of stuff that I'm working on there. It's just sort of, you know, I'm not quite there because I'm like at the stage of, do I turn these into full ads, you know, or little like theme intros with like visuals, or do I just kind of like put the music out there? But I'll send you some stuff, maybe attach, you know, one to the end of this, you know. But it's definitely fun, and it sort of gives me a bit of a chance to, you know, flex a bit of a creative, you know, muscle that I don't always get to flex, and combine my love of like these strips and kind of what I do day to day. So yeah, you know, I've made jingles for like Rogue Trooper, and, you know, theme songs for like, you know, Halo Jones, or a new wave song for Zenith, or, you know, Bad Company song in the style of, you know, if it was Tour of Duty on TV. So yeah, a lot of fun. And I'll probably go and post, you know, some of this stuff on various forums or whatever, or email you. But yeah, that's kind of like where I'm at. I've got a, I guess I'd say, a guest project in process, you know, not quite there yet.
Well, it sounds great fun. And hopefully we might be able to have a little snippet at the end of this episode.
Yeah.
As we go out.
Yeah.
And thank you so much for coming on the show, giving up your time and talking about The War Machine and Dave Gibbons and Will Simpson. Great fun.
Yeah. Yeah, man. Loved it. Absolutely loved it. Any chance to, you know, it's my first time actually having a serious conversation with anyone about 2000 AD stuff. I've never been to a comic con. I've never, you know, I just sort of do this stuff at home as a hobbyist. And yeah, I'm not super on the socials or whatever, you know, like, tune into all the podcasts and, you know, love all of that. Just love listening to everyone. So you have so many incredible guests. So it's great. I mean, other than, now I know you like this. I know Garth Ennis loves The War Machine. I've heard him say that he loved that strip in particular, which is fantastic. Not too many people. So it's good to kind of like get, you know, wave the flag for these kind of, these books that aren't the, you know, the big dread epics or whatever.
Yeah.
But yeah. Yeah, for sure. Thank you so much, man. Can't wait to chat about something else.
No, absolutely. I look forward to your next pick, and I'll get you off air to send me your snail mail address, and I'll post your book club coaster all the way down to Oz for you.
Yeah. Cheers, mate.
Thank you so much, Ant. And thank you to everyone for listening to Mega City Book Club. Find all the links at megacitybookclub.com. Follow on Facebook, Instagram, Threads, Blue Sky, Mastodon, and the 2080 forums. Or, like Ant, email me at mcbcpodcast@gmail.com, particularly if you have a book, a story, a creator that you want to come on and talk about. And that'll do us. Until next time, we're passing judgment on another great book. It's goodbye from me and...
goodbye from me.